Disc 4.
A day or two later, Colonel Melchett and Superintendent Harper looked at each other across the former's big desk. Harper had come over to Much Benham for a consultation. Melchett said gloomily, "Well, we know where we are, or rather where we aren't." "Where we aren't expresses it better, sir." "We've got two deaths to take into account," said Melchett. "Two murders. Ruby Keene and the child Pamela Reeves. Not much to identify her by, poor kid, but enough. That shoe that escaped burning has been identified positively as hers by her father, and there's this button from her Girl Guide uniform. A fiendish business, Superintendent." Superintendent Harper said very quietly, "I'll say you're right, sir." "I'm glad it's quite certain she was dead before the car was set on fire. The way she was lying, thrown across the seat, shows that. Probably knocked on the head, poor kid. Or strangled, perhaps," said Harper. Melchett looked at him sharply. "You think so?" "Well, sir, there are murderers like that." "I know. I've seen the parents. The poor girl's mother's beside herself. Damned painful, the whole thing. The point for us to settle is, are the two murders connected?" "I'd say definitely yes." "So would I." The superintendent ticked off the points on his fingers. "Pamela Reeves attended rally of Girl Guides on Danebury Downs, stated by companions to be normal and cheerful. Did not return with three companions by the bus to Medchester. Said to them that she was going into Danemouth to Woolworths and would take the bus home from there. The main road into Danemouth from the Downs does a big round inland. Pamela Reeves took a shortcut over two fields and a footpath and a lane, which would bring her into Danemouth near the Majestic Hotel. The lane, in fact, actually passes the hotel on the west side. It's possible, therefore, that she overheard or saw something concerning Ruby Keene, which would have proved dangerous to the murderer. Say, for instance, that she heard him arranging to meet Ruby Keene at 11 that evening. He realizes that this schoolgirl has overheard, and he has to silence her." Colonel Melchett said, "That's presuming, Harper, that the Ruby Keene crime was premeditated, not spontaneous." Superintendent Harper agreed. "I believe it was, sir. It looks as though it would be the other way. Sudden violence, a fit of passion or jealousy. But I'm beginning to think that that's not so. I don't see otherwise how you can account for the death of the Reeves child. If she was a witness of the actual crime, it would be late at night, round about 11 p.m. And what would she be doing about the Majestic at that time? Why, at 9 o'clock, her parents were getting anxious because she hadn't returned. The alternative is that she went to meet someone in Danemouth unknown to her family and friends, and that her death is quite unconnected with the other death. Yes, sir, and I don't believe that's so. Look how even the old lady, old Miss Marple, tumbled to it at once that there was a connection. She asked at once if the body in the burnt car was the body of the missing girl guide. Very smart old lady, that. These old ladies are sometimes shrewd, you know, put their fingers on the vital spot." "Miss Marple has done that more than once," said Colonel Melchett dryly. "And besides, sir, there's the car. That seems to me to link up her death definitely with the Majestic Hotel. It was Mr. George Bartlett's car." Again the eyes of the two men met. Melchett said, "George Bartlett. Could be. What do you think?" Again Harper methodically recited various points. "Ruby Keene was last seen with George Bartlett. He says she went to her room, borne out by the dress she was wearing being found there. But did she go to her room and change in order to go out with him? Had they made a date to go out together earlier, discussed it, say, before dinner? And did Pamela Reeves happen to overhear?" Melchett said, "He didn't report the loss of his car until the following morning, and he was extremely vague about it then, pretended he couldn't remember exactly when he'd last noticed it. That might be cleverness, sir. As I see it, he's either a very clever gentleman pretending to be a silly ass, Or else, well, he is a silly ass. What we want, said Melchett, is motive. As it stands, he had no motive whatever for killing Ruby Keene. Yes, that's where we're stuck every time, motive. All the reports from the Palais de Danse at Brixwell are negative, I understand. Absolutely. Ruby Keene had no special boyfriend. Slack's been into the matter thoroughly. Give Slack his due, he is thorough. That's right, sir. Thorough's the word. If there was anything to ferret out, he'd have ferreted it out. But there's nothing there. He's got a list of her most frequent dancing partners, all vetted and found correct. Harmless fellows, and all able to produce alibis for that night. Ah, said Superintendent Harper, alibis. That's what we're up against. Melchett looked at him sharply. Think so? I've left that side of the investigation to you. Yes, sir. It's been gone into, very thoroughly. We applied to London for help over it. Well? Mr. Conway Jefferson may think that Mr. Gaskell and young Mrs. Jefferson are comfortably off, but that is not the case. They're both extremely hard up. Is that true? Quite true, sir. It's as Mr. Conway Jefferson said. He made over considerable sums of money to his son and daughter when they married. That was over 10 years ago, though. Mr. Jefferson fancied himself as knowing good investments. He didn't invest in anything absolutely wildcat, but he was unlucky and showed poor judgment more than once. His holdings have gone steadily down. I should say the widow found it difficult to make both ends meet and send her son to a good school. But she hasn't applied to her father-in-law for help. No, sir. As far as I can make out, she lives with him, and consequently has no household expenses. And his health is such that he wasn't expected to live long. That's right, sir. Now for Mr. Mark Gaskell. He's a gambler, pure and simple. Got through his wife's money very soon. Has got himself tangled up rather critically just at present. He needs money badly, and a good deal of it. Can't say I like the looks of him much, said Colonel Melchett. Wild-looking sort of fellow, what? And he's got a motive, all right. £25,000 it meant to him, getting that girl out of the way. Yes, it's a motive, all right. They both had a motive. I'm not considering Mrs. Jefferson. No, sir, I know you're not. And anyway, the alibi holds for both of them. They couldn't have done it. Just that. You've got a detailed statement of their movements that evening? Yes, I have. Take Mr. Gaskell first. He dined with his father-in-law and Mrs. Jefferson, had coffee with them afterwards when Ruby Keene joined them. Then he said he had to write letters and left them. Actually, he took his car and went for a spin down to the front. He told me, quite frankly, he couldn't stick playing bridge for a whole evening. The old boy's mad on it. So he made letters an excuse. Ruby Keene remained with the others. Mark Gaskell returned when she was dancing with Raymond. After the dance, Ruby came and had a drink with them. Then she went off with young Bartlett, and Gaskell and the others cut for partners and started their bridge. That was at 11:20, and he didn't leave the table until after midnight. That's quite certain, sir. Everyone says so. The family, the waiters, everyone. Therefore, he couldn't have done it. And Mrs. Jefferson's alibi is the same. She, too, didn't leave the table. They're out. Both of them. Out. Colonel Melchett leant back, tapping the table with a paper cutter. Superintendent Harper said, "That is, assuming the girl was killed before midnight." "Well, Haydock says she was. He's a very sound fellow in police work. If he says a thing, it's so." "There might be reasons. Health, physical idiosyncrasy, or something." "I'll put it to him." Melchett glanced at his watch, picked up the telephone receiver, and asked for a number. He said, "Haydock ought to be at home at this time. Now, assuming that she was killed after midnight." Harper said, "Then there might be a chance. There was some coming and going afterwards. Let's assume that Gaskell had asked the girl to meet him outside somewhere, say at 12:20. He slips away for a minute or two, strangles her, comes back, and disposes of the body later. in the early hours of the morning. Melchett said, "Takes her by car 30-odd miles to put her in Bantry's library. Oh, dash it all, it's not a likely story." "No, it isn't," the superintendent admitted at once. The telephone rang. Melchett picked up the receiver. "Hello, hey Doc, is that you?" "Ruby Keane. Would it be possible for her to have been killed after midnight?" "I told you she was killed between 10 and midnight." "Yes, I know, but one could stretch it a bit." "What?" "No, you couldn't stretch it. When I say she was killed before midnight, I mean before midnight. And don't try to tamper with the medical evidence." "Yes, but couldn't there be some physiological whatnot? You know what I mean." "I know that you don't know what you're talking about. The girl was perfectly healthy and not abnormal in any way. And I'm not going to say she was, just to help you fit a rope round the neck of some wretched fellow whom you police wallers have got your knife into. Now, don't protest. I know your ways. Oh, and by the way, the girl wasn't strangled willingly. That is to say, she was drugged first. Powerful narcotic. She died of strangulation, but she was drugged first." Haydock rang off. Melchett said gloomily, "Well, that's that." Harper said, "Thought I'd found another likely starter, but it petered out." "What's that? Who?" "Strictly speaking, he's your pigeon, sir. Name of Basil Blake. Lives near Gossington Hall." "Impudent young jackanapes!" The Colonel's brow darkened as he remembered Basil Blake's outrageous rudeness. "How's he mixed up in it?" "Seems he knew Ruby Keane. Dined over at the Majestic quite often, danced with the girl. Do you remember what Josie said to Raymond when Ruby was discovered to be missing? She's not with that film fellow, is she?" "Well, I found out it was Blake she meant. He's employed with the Lemville Studios, you know. Josie has nothing to go on except a belief that Ruby was rather keen on him." "Oh, very promising, Harper, very promising." "Oh, not so good as it sounds, sir. Basil Blake was at a party at the studios that night. You know the sort of thing. Starts at 8 with cocktails and goes on until the air's too thick to see through and everyone passes out. According to Inspector Slack, who's questioned him, he left the show round about midnight. At midnight, Ruby Keane was dead." "Anyone bear out his statement?" "Oh, most of them, I gather, sir, were rather, far gone. The young woman now at the bungalow, Miss Dinah Lee, says his statement is correct." "What, doesn't mean a thing?" No, sir, probably not. Statements taken from other members of the party bear Mr. Blake's statement out on the whole, though ideas as to time are somewhat vague." "Oh, where are these studios?" "Lemville, sir. 30 miles southwest of London." "About the same distance from here?" "Yes, sir." Colonel Melchett rubbed his nose. He said, in a rather dissatisfied tone, "Well, it looks as though we could wash him out." "I think so, sir. There is no evidence that he was seriously attracted by Ruby Keane. In fact," Superintendent Harper coughed primly, "he seems fully occupied with his own young lady." Melchett said, "Well, we are left with X, an unknown murderer. So unknown, Slack can't find a trace of him. Or Jefferson's son-in-law, who might have wanted to kill the girl, but didn't have a chance to do so, daughter-in-law ditto. Or George Bartlett, who has no alibi, but unfortunately no motive either. Or with young Blake, who has an alibi and no motive. And that's the lot." No, stop. I suppose we ought to consider the dancing fellow, Raymond Starr. After all, he saw a lot of the girl." Harper said slowly, "I can't believe he took much interest in her, or else he's a thundering good actor. And for all practical purposes, he's got an alibi, too. He was more or less in view from 11:20 until midnight, dancing with various partners. I don't see that we can make a case against him." "In fact," said Colonel Melchett, "we can't make a case against anybody." George Bartlett's our best hope. If we could only hit on a motive. You've had him looked up? Yes, sir. Only child, coddled by his mother. Came into a good deal of money on her death a year ago. Getting through it fast. Weak, rather than vicious. Maybe mental? Said Melchett hopefully. Superintendent Harper nodded. He said, Has it struck you, sir, that that may be the explanation of the whole case? Criminal lunatic, you mean? Yes, sir. One of those fellows who go about strangling young girls. Doctors have a long name for it. Well, that would solve all our difficulties, said Melchett. There's only one thing I don't like about it, said Superintendent Harper. What? It's too easy. Yes, perhaps. So, as I said at the beginning, where are we? Nowhere, sir, said Superintendent Harper. Conway Jefferson stirred in his sleep and stretched. His arms were flung out, long, powerful arms, into which all the strength of his body seemed to be concentrated since his accident. Through the curtains the morning light glowed softly. Conway Jefferson smiled to himself. Always, after a night of rest, he woke like this, happy, refreshed, his deep vitality renewed. Another day. So, for a minute, he lay. Then he pressed the special bell by his hand, and suddenly a wave of remembrance swept over him. Even as Edwards, deft and quiet-footed, entered the room, a groan was wrung from his master. Edwards paused with his hand on the curtains. He said, You're not in pain, sir? Conway Jefferson said harshly. No! Go on, pull 'em! The clear light flooded the room. Edwards, understanding, did not glance at his master. His face grim, Conway Jefferson lay remembering and thinking. Before his eyes he saw again the pretty, vapid face of Ruby. Only in his mind he did not use the adjective vapid. Last night he would have said innocent, a naive, innocent child. And now? A great weariness came over Conway Jefferson. He closed his eyes. He murmured below his breath, Margaret. It was the name of his dead wife. "'I like your friend,' said Adelaide Jefferson to Mrs. Bantry. The two women were sitting on the terrace. "'Jane Marple's a really remarkable woman,' said Mrs. Bantry. "'She's nice, too,' said Addie, smiling. "'People call her a scandalmonger,' said Mrs. Bantry. "'But she isn't really. "'Just a low opinion of human nature? "'You could call it that.' "'It's rather refreshing,' said Adelaide Jefferson, "'after having had too much of the other thing.' Mrs. Bantry looked at her sharply. Addie explained herself. So much high thinking, idealization of an unworthy object. You mean Ruby Keene? Addie nodded. I don't want to be horrid about her. There wasn't any harm in her. Poor little rat. She had to fight for what she wanted. But she wasn't bad. Common and rather silly, and quite good-natured. But a decided little gold-digger. I don't think she schemed or planned... It was just that she was quick to take advantage of a possibility, and she knew just how to appeal to an elderly man who was lonely. I suppose, said Mrs. Bantry thoughtfully, that Conway was lonely. Addie moved restlessly. She said, He was, this summer. She paused, and then burst out, Mark will have it, that it was all my fault. Perhaps it was. I don't know. She was silent for a minute. Then, impelled by some need to talk, she went on speaking in a difficult, almost reluctant way. I've had such an odd sort of life. Mike Carmody, my first husband, died so soon after we were married. It knocked me out. Peter, as you know, was born after his death. Frank Jefferson was Mike's great friend, so I came to see a lot of him. He was Peter's godfather. Mike had wanted that. I got very fond of him, and, oh, sorry for him, too. "'Sorry?' queried Mrs. Bantry with interest. Yes, just that. It sounds odd. Frank had always had everything he wanted. His father and his mother couldn't have been nicer to him, and yet, how can I say it? You see, old Mr. Jefferson's personality is so strong. If you live with it, you can't somehow have a personality of your own. Frank felt that. When we were married, he was very happy, wonderfully so. Mr. Jefferson was very generous. He settled a large sum of money on Frank, said he wanted his children to be independent and not to have to wait for his death. It was so nice of him, so generous. But it was much too sudden. He ought really to have accustomed Frank to independence little by little. It went to Frank's head. He wanted to be as good a man as his father, as clever about money and business, as far-seeing and successful. And, of course, he wasn't. He didn't exactly speculate with the money, but he invested in the wrong things at the wrong time. It's frightening, you know, how soon money goes if you're not clever about it. The more Frank dropped, the more eager he was to get it back by some clever deal. So things went from bad to worse. "But, my dear," said Mrs. Bantry, "couldn't Conway have advised him?" "He didn't want to be advised. The one thing he wanted was to do well on his own. That's why we never let Mr. Jefferson know. When Frank died, there was very little left, only a tiny income for me. And I didn't let his father know either. You see," she turned abruptly, "it would have felt like betraying Frank to him. Frank would have hated it so. Mr. Jefferson was ill for a long time. When he got well, he assumed that I was a very well-off widow. I've never undeceived him. It's been a point of honour. He knows I'm very careful about money, but he approves of that, thinks I'm a thrifty sort of woman. And, of course, Peter and I have lived with him practically ever since, and he's paid for all our living expenses, so I've never had to worry." She said slowly, "We've been like a family all these years. Only, you see, or don't you see, I've never been Frank's widow to him. I've been Frank's wife." Mrs. Bantry grasped the implication.
"You mean he's never accepted their deaths?"
"No. He's been wonderful, but he's conquered his own terrible tragedy by refusing to recognize death. Mark is Rosamond's husband, and I'm Frank's wife. And though Frank and Rosamond aren't exactly here with us, they are still existent." Mrs. Bantry said softly, "It's a wonderful triumph of faith." "I know. We've gone on, year after year, but suddenly, this summer, something went wrong in me. I felt rebellious. It's an awful thing to say, but I didn't want to think of Frank any more. All that was over, my love and companionship with him, and my grief when he died. It was something that had been and wasn't any longer. It's awfully hard to describe. It's like wanting to wipe the slate clean and start again. I wanted to be me, Addie, still reasonably young and strong and able to play games and swim and dance, just a person. Even Hugo, you know Hugo MacLean, he's a dear and wants to marry me, but of course I've never really thought of it. But this summer I did begin to think of it, not seriously, only vaguely." She stopped and shook her head. "And so I suppose it's true. I neglected Jeff. I don't mean really neglected him, but my mind and thoughts weren't with him. When Ruby, as I saw, amused him, I was rather glad. It left me freer to go and do my own things. I never dreamed, of course I never dreamed, that he would be so infatuated by her." Mrs. Bantry asked, "And when you did find out?" "I was dumbfounded, absolutely dumbfounded, and I'm afraid angry, too." "I'd have been angry," said Mrs. Bantry. "There was Peter, you see. Peter's whole future depends on Jeff. Jeff practically looked on him as a grandson, or so I thought, but of course He wasn't a grandson. He was no relation at all. And to think that he was going to be disinherited. Her firm, well-shaped hands shook a little where they lay in her lap. For that's what it felt like. And for a vulgar, gold-digging little simpleton, oh, I could have killed her! She stopped, stricken. Her beautiful hazel eyes met Mrs. Bantry's in a pleading horror. She said, "Oh, what an awful thing to say." Hugo McLean, coming quietly up behind them, asked, "What's an awful thing to say?" "Oh, sit down, Hugo. You know Mrs. Bantry, don't you?" McLean had already greeted the older lady. He said now, in a low, persevering way, "What was an awful thing to say?" Addie Jefferson said, "That I'd like to have killed Ruby Keene." Hugo McLean reflected a minute or two. Then he said, "No, I wouldn't say that if I were you. Might be misunderstood." His eyes, steady, reflective grey eyes, looked at her meaningly. He said, "You've got to watch your step, Addie." There was warning in his voice. When Miss Marple came out of the hotel and joined Mrs. Bantry a few minutes later, Hugo McLean and Adelaide Jefferson were walking down the path to the sea together. Seating herself, Miss Marple remarked, "He seems very devoted." "He's been devoted for years. One of those men." "I know. Like Major Berry. He hung round an Anglo-Indian widow for quite 10 years, a joke among her friends. In the end, she gave in. But unfortunately, 10 days before they were to have been married, she ran away with the chauffeur. Such a nice woman, too, and usually so well-balanced." "People do very odd things," agreed Mrs. Bantry. "I wish you'd been here just now, Jane. Addie Jefferson was telling me all about herself, how her husband went through all his money, but they never let Mr. Jefferson know, and then, this summer, things felt different to her." Miss Marple nodded. "Yes, she rebelled, I suppose, against being made to live in the past. After all, there's a time for everything. You can't sit in the house with the blinds down forever. I suppose Mrs. Jefferson just pulled them up and took off her widow's weeds, and her father-in-law, of course, didn't like it. Felt left out in the cold, though I don't suppose for a minute he realized who put her up to it. Still, he certainly wouldn't like it. And so, of course, like old Mr. Badger, when his wife took up spiritualism, he was just ripe for what happened. Any fairly nice-looking young girl who listened prettily would have done."
"Do you think," said Mrs. Bantry, "that that cousin, Josie, got her down here deliberately? That it was a family plot?"
Miss Marple shook her head. "No, I don't think so at all. I don't think Josie has the kind of mind that could foresee people's reactions. She's rather dense in that way. She's got one of those shrewd, limited, practical minds that never do foresee the future and are usually astonished by it."
"It seems to have taken everyone by surprise," said Mrs. Bantry. "Addie and Mark Gaskell, too, apparently."
Miss Marple smiled.
"I dare say he had his own fish to fry. A bold fellow with a roving eye. Not the man to go on being a sorrowing widower for years, no matter how fond he may have been of his wife. I should think they were both restless under old Mr. Jefferson's yoke of perpetual remembrance. Only," added Miss Marple cynically, "it's easier for gentlemen, of course."
At that very moment, Mark was confirming this judgment on himself in a talk with Sir Henry Clithering. With characteristic candour, Mark had gone straight to the heart of things. "It's just dawned on me," he said, "that I'm favourite suspect number one to the police. They've been delving into my financial troubles. I'm broke, you know, or very nearly. If dear old Jeff dies according to schedule in a month or two, and Addie and I divide the dibs also according to schedule, all will be well. Matter of fact, I owe rather a lot. If the crash comes, it will be a big one. If I can stave it off, it'll be the other way round. I shall come out on top and be a very rich man." Sir Henry Clithering said, "You're a gambler, Mark." "Always have been. Risk everything. That's my motto. Yes, it's a lucky thing for me that somebody strangled that poor kid. I didn't do it. I'm not a strangler. I don't really think I could ever murder anybody. I'm too easygoing. But I don't suppose I can ask the police to believe that. I must look to them like the answer to the criminal investigator's prayer. I had a motive, was on the spot. I am not burdened with high moral scruples. I can't imagine why I'm not in the jug already. That superintendent's got a very nasty eye. You've got that useful thing, an alibi. An alibi is the fishiest thing on God's earth. No innocent person ever has an alibi. Besides, it all depends on the time of death, or something like that. And you may be sure if three doctors say the girl was killed at midnight, at least six will be found who will swear positively that she was killed at 5 in the morning. And where's my alibi then? At any rate, we're able to joke about it. Damn bad taste, isn't it? Said Mark cheerfully. Actually, I'm rather scared. One is, with murder. And don't think I'm not sorry for old Jeff. I am. But it's better this way, bad as the shock was, than if he'd found her out. What do you mean, found her out? Mark winked. Where did she go off to last night? I'll lay you any odds you like. She went to meet a man. Jeff wouldn't have liked that. He wouldn't have liked it at all. If he'd found she was deceiving him, that she wasn't the prattling little innocent she seemed, well, my father-in-law is an odd man. He's a man of great self-control, but that self-control can snap. And then, look out! Sir Henry glanced at him curiously. Are you fond of him, or not? I'm very fond of him. And at the same time, I resent him. I'll try and explain. Conway Jefferson is a man who likes to control his surroundings. He's a benevolent despot, kind, generous, and affectionate. But his is the tune, and the others dance to his piping. Mark Gaskell paused. I loved my wife. I shall never feel the same for anyone else. Rosamond was sunshine, and laughter, and flowers. And when she was killed, I felt just like a man in the ring who's had a knockout blow. But the referee's been counting a good long time now. I'm a man, after all. I like women. I don't want to marry again, not in the least. Well, that's all right. I've had to be discreet, but I've had my good times all right. Poor Addie hasn't. Addie's a really nice woman. She's the kind of woman men want to marry, not to sleep with. Give her half a chance and she would marry again, and be very happy and make the chap happy too. But old Jeff saw her always as Frank's wife, and hypnotized her into seeing herself like that. He doesn't know it, but we've been in prison. I broke out on the quiet a long time ago. Addie broke out this summer, and it gave him quite a shock. It split up his world. Result? Ruby Keene. Irrepressibly, he sang. But she is in her grave, and oh, the difference to me. Come and have a drink, Clithering. It was hardly surprising, Sir Henry reflected, that Mark Gaskell should be an object of suspicion to the police. Dr. Metcalf was one of the best-known physicians in Danemath. He had no aggressive bedside manner, but his presence in the sickroom had an invariably cheering effect. He was middle-aged, with a quiet, pleasant voice. He listened carefully to Superintendent Harper, and replied to his questions with gentle precision. Harper said, "Then I can take it, Dr. Metcalf, that what I was told by Mrs. Jefferson was substantially correct?" "Yes. Mr. Jefferson's health is in a precarious state. For several years now the man has been driving himself ruthlessly. In his determination to live like other men, he has lived at a far greater pace than the normal man of his age. He has refused to rest, to take things easy, to go slow, or any of the other phrases with which I and his other medical advisers have tendered our opinion. The result is that the man is an overworked engine. Heart, lungs, blood pressure, they're all overstrained. You say Mr. Jefferson has absolutely refused to listen. Yes, I don't know that I blame him. It's not what I say to my patient, Superintendent, but a man may as well wear out as rust out. A lot of my colleagues do that, and take it from me, it's not a bad way. In a place like Danemath, one sees most of the other thing. Invalids clinging to life, terrified of overexerting themselves, terrified of a breath of draughty air, of a stray germ, of an injudicious meal. "I expect that's true enough," said Superintendent Harper. "What it amounts to, then, is this. Conway Jefferson is strong enough, physically speaking, or I suppose I mean muscularly speaking. Just what can he do in the active line, by the way? He has immense strength in his arms and shoulders. He was a powerful man before his accident. He's extremely dexterous in his handling of his wheelchair, and with the aid of crutches he can move himself about a room, from his bed to the chair, for instance. Isn't it possible for a man injured, as Mr. Jefferson was, to have artificial legs? Not in his case. There was a spine injury." "I see. Well, let me sum up again. Jefferson is strong and fit in the muscular sense. He feels well and all that?" Metcalf nodded. "But his heart is in a bad condition. Any overstrain or exertion or a shock or a sudden fright and he might pop off, is that it?" "More or less. Overexertion is killing him slowly, because he won't give in when he feels tired. That aggravates the cardiac condition. It is unlikely that exertion would kill him suddenly, but a sudden shock or fright might easily do so. That is why I expressly warned his family." Superintendent Harper said slowly, "But in actual fact, a shock didn't kill him. I mean, Doctor, that there couldn't have been a much worse shock than this business, and he's still alive." Dr. Metcalf shrugged his shoulders. "I know. But if you'd had my experience, Superintendent, you'd know that case history shows the impossibility of prognosticating accurately. People who ought to die of shock and exposure don't die of shock and exposure, etc., etc. The human frame is tougher than one can imagine possible. Moreover, in my experience, a physical shock is often more fatal than a mental shock. In plain language, a door banging suddenly would be more likely to kill Mr. Jefferson than the discovery that a girl he was fond of had died in a particularly horrible manner. Why is that, I wonder? The breaking of a piece of bad news nearly always sets up a defense reaction. It numbs the recipient. They are unable at first to take it in. Full realization takes a little time, but the banged door, someone jumping out of a cupboard, the sudden onslaught of a motor as you cross a road, all those things are immediate in their action. The heart gives a terrified leap, to put it in layman's language. Superintendent Harper said slowly, "But as far as anyone would know, Mr. Jefferson's death might easily have been caused by the shock of the girl's death." "Oh, easily." The doctor looked curiously at the other. "You don't think..." "I don't know what I think," said Superintendent Harper vexedly. "But you'll admit, sir, that the two things would fit in very prettily together," he said a little later to Sir Henry Clithering. "Kill two birds with one stone. First the girl, and the fact of her death takes off Mr. Jefferson too, before he's had any opportunity of altering his will. Do you think he will alter it?" "Ah, you'd be more likely to know that, sir, than I would. What do you say?" "I don't know. Before Ruby Keene came on the scene, I happened to know that he had left his money between Mark Gaskell and Mrs. Jefferson. I don't see why he should now change his mind about that. But, of course, he might do so. Might leave it to a cat's home, or to subsidize young professional dancers." Superintendent Harper agreed. "You never know what be a man is going to get in his bonnet, especially when he doesn't feel there is any moral obligation in the disposal of his fortune. No blood relations in this case." Sir Henry said, "He's fond of the boy, of young Peter." "Do you think he regards him as a grandson? You'd know that better than I would, sir." Sir Henry said slowly, "No, I don't think so. There's another thing I'd like to ask you, sir. It's a thing I can't judge for myself, but they're friends of yours, and so you'd know. I'd like very much to know just how fond Mr. Jefferson is of Mr. Gaskell and young Mrs. Jefferson." Sir Henry frowned. "I'm not sure if I understand you, Superintendent." "Well, it's this way, sir. How fond is he of them as persons, apart from his relationship to them?" "Ah, I see what you mean." "Yes, sir. Nobody doubts that he was very attached to them both. but he was attached to them as I see it because they were, respectively, the husband and the wife of his daughter and his son. But supposing, for instance, one of them had married again. Sir Henry reflected. He said, "It's an interesting point you raise there. I don't know. I'm inclined to suspect, this is mere opinion, that it would have altered his attitude a good deal. He would have wished them well, borne no rancour, but I think, yes, I rather think that he would have taken very little more interest in them." "In both cases, sir?" "I think so, yes. In Mr. Gaskell's, almost certainly, and I rather think in Mrs. Jefferson's also. But that's not nearly so certain. I think he was fond of her for her own sake." "Sex would have something to do with that," said Superintendent Harper, sapiently. "Easier for him to look on her as a daughter than to look on Mr. Gaskell as a son. It works both ways. Women accept a son-in-law as one of the family easily enough, but there aren't many times when a woman looks on her son's wife as a daughter." Superintendent Harper went on. "Mind if we walk along this path, sir, to the tennis court? I see Miss Marple sitting there. I want to ask her to do something for me. As a matter of fact, I want to rope you both in."
"In what way, Superintendent?"
"To get at stuff that I can't get at myself. I want you to tackle Edwards for me, sir."
"Edwards? What do you want from him?"
"Everything you can think of, everything he knows and what he thinks, about the relations between the various members of the family, his angle on the Ruby Keene business, inside stuff. He knows better than anyone the state of affairs, oh, you bet he does, and he won't tell me, but he'll tell you, and something might turn up from it. That is, of course, if you don't object."
Sir Henry said grimly, "I don't object. I've been sent for, urgently, to get at the truth. I mean to do my utmost." He added, "How do you want Miss Marple to help you?"
"With some girls. Some of those girl guides. We've rounded up half a dozen or so, the ones who were most friendly with Pamela Reeves. It's possible that they may know something. You see, I've been thinking. It seems to me that if that girl was really going to Woolworth's, she would have tried to persuade one of the other girls to go with her.
Girls usually like to shop with someone."
"Yes, I think that's true. So, I think it's possible that Woolworth's was only an excuse. I want to know where the girl was really going. She may have let slip something. If so, I feel Miss Marple's the person to get it out of these girls. I'd say she knows a thing or two about girls, more than I do. And anyway, they'd be scared of the police.
It sounds to me the kind of village domestic problem that is right up Miss Marple's street. She's very sharp, you know."
The superintendent smiled. He said, "I'll say you're right. Nothing much gets past her." Miss Marple looked up at their approach and welcomed them eagerly. She listened to the superintendent's request and at once acquiesced. "I should like to help you very much, Superintendent, and I think that perhaps I could be of some use. What with the Sunday school, you know, and the brownies, and our guides and the orphanage quite near. I'm on the committee, you know, and often run in to have a little talk with matron. And then servants. I usually have very young maids. Oh, yes, I have quite a lot of experience in when a girl is speaking the truth and when she is holding something back."
"In fact, you're an expert," said Sir Henry.
Miss Marple flashed him a reproachful glance and said, "Oh, please, don't laugh at me, Sir Henry."
"I shouldn't dream of laughing at you. You've had the laugh of me too many times."
"One does see so much evil in a village," murmured Miss Marple in an explanatory voice.
"By the way," said Sir Henry, "I've cleared up one point you asked me about. The superintendent tells me that there were nail clippings in Ruby's waste paper basket."
Miss Marple said thoughtfully, "There were. Then that's that."
"Why did you want to know, Miss Marple?" asked the superintendent.
Miss Marple said, "It was one of the things that, well, that seemed wrong when I looked at the body. The hands were wrong somehow, and I couldn't at first think why. Then I realized that girls who are very much made up, and all that, usually have very long fingernails. Of course, I know that girls everywhere do bite their nails. It's one of those habits that are very hard to break oneself of. But vanity often does a lot to help. Still, I presumed that this girl hadn't cured herself. And then the little boy, Peter, you know, he said something which showed that her nails had been long, only she caught one and broke it. So then, of course, she might have trimmed off the rest to make an even appearance. And I asked about clippings, and Sir Henry said he'd find out.
Sir Henry remarked, "You said just now one of the things that seemed wrong when you looked at the body. Was there something else?"
Miss Marple nodded vigorously. "Oh, yes," she said. "There was the dress. The dress was all wrong."
Both men looked at her curiously. "Now, why?" said Sir Henry.
"Well, you see, it was an old dress. Josie said so, definitely, and I could see for myself that it was shabby and rather worn. Now, that's all wrong."
"I don't see why."
Miss Marple got a little pink. "Well, the idea is, isn't it, that Ruby Keene changed her dress and went off to meet someone on whom she presumably had what my young nephews call a crush."
The superintendent's eyes twinkled a little. "That's the theory. She'd got a date with someone, a boyfriend, as the saying goes."
"Then why," demanded Miss Marple, "was she wearing an old dress?"
The superintendent scratched his head thoughtfully. He said, "I see your point. You think she'd wear a new one."
"I think she'd wear her best dress.
Girls do." Sir Henry interposed. "Yes, but look here, Miss Marple. Suppose she was going outside to this rendezvous, going in an open car, perhaps, or walking in some rough going. Then she'd not want to risk messing a new frock, and she'd put on an old one."
"Well, that would be the sensible thing to do," agreed the superintendent.
Miss Marple turned on him. She spoke with animation. "The sensible thing to do would be to change into trousers and a pullover, or into tweeds. That, of course, I don't want to be snobbish, but I'm afraid it's unavoidable. That's what a girl of our class would do. A well-bred girl," continued Miss Marple, warming to her subject, "is always very particular to wear the right clothes for the right occasion. I mean, however hot the day was, a well-bred girl would never turn up at a point-to-point in a silk-flowered frock."
"And the correct wear to meet a lover?" demanded Sir Henry.
"If she were to meet him inside the hotel, or somewhere where evening dress was worn, she'd wear her best evening frock, of course. But outside, she'd feel she'd look ridiculous in evening dress, and she'd wear her most attractive sportswear."
"Granted, fashion queen. But the girl, Ruby,"
Miss Marple said. "Ruby, of course, wasn't a lady. She belonged to the class that wear their best clothes, however unsuitable to the occasion. Last year, you know, we had a picnic outing at Scrantor Rocks. You'd be surprised at the unsuitable clothes the girls wore. Foulard dresses and patent shoes and quite elaborate hats, some of them, for climbing about over rocks and in gorse and heather, and the young men in their best suits. Of course, hiking's different again. That's practically a uniform. And girls don't seem to realize that shorts are very unbecoming unless they're very slender."
The superintendent said slowly, "And you think that Ruby Keene?"
"I think that she'd have kept on the frock she was wearing, her best pink one. She'd only have changed it if she'd had something newer still."
Superintendent Harper said, "And what's your explanation, Miss Marple?"
Miss Marple said, "I haven't got one yet, but I can't help feeling that it's important."
Inside the wire cage, the tennis lesson that Raymond Starr was giving had come to an end. A stout, middle-aged woman uttered a few appreciative squeaks, picked up a sky-blue cardigan, and went off towards the hotel. Raymond called out a few gay words after her. Then he turned towards the bench where the three onlookers were sitting. The balls dangled in a net in his hand, his racket was under one arm. The gay, laughing expression on his face was wiped off as though by a sponge from a slate. He looked tired and worried. Coming towards them, he said, "That's over." Then the smile broke out again, that charming, boyish, expressive smile that went so harmoniously with his sun-tanned face and dark, lithe grace. Sir Henry found himself wondering how old the man was. 25, 30, 35, it was impossible to say. Raymond said, shaking his head a little, "She'll never be able to play, you know."
"All this must be very boring for you," said Miss Marple.
Raymond said simply, "It is, sometimes, especially at the end of the summer. For a time, the thought of the pay buoys you up, but even that fails to stimulate imagination in the end."
Superintendent Harper got up. He said abruptly, "I'll call for you in half an hour's time, Miss Marple, if that will be all right."
"Perfectly, thank you. I shall be ready."
Harper went off. Raymond stood looking after him. Then he said, "Mind if I sit here for a bit?"
"Do," said Sir Henry.
"Have a cigarette." He offered his case, wondering as he did so why he had a slight feeling of prejudice against Raymond Starr. Was it simply because he was a professional tennis coach and dancer? If so, it wasn't the tennis, it was the dancing. The English, Sir Henry decided, had a distrust for any man who danced too well. This fellow moved with too much grace. Ramon Raymond, which was his name? Abruptly, he asked the question. The other seemed amused.
"Ramon was my original professional name. Ramon and Josie. Spanish effect, you know. Then there was rather a prejudice against foreigners, so I became Raymond. Very British."
Miss Marple said, "And is your real name something quite different?" He smiled at her.
"Actually, my real name is Ramon. I had an Argentine grandmother, you see."
"And that accounts for that swing from the hips," thought Sir Henry, parenthetically.
"But my first name is Thomas, painfully prosaic."
He turned to Sir Henry.
"You come from Devonshire, don't you, sir? From Stane? My people live down that way, at Alsmanston."
Sir Henry's face lit up.
"Are you one of the Alsmanston Stars? I didn't realize that."
"No, I don't suppose you would." There was a slight bitterness in his voice. Sir Henry said awkwardly,
"Bad luck, all that. The place being sold up after it had been in the family for 300 years. Yes, it was, rather. Still, our kind have to go, I suppose. We've outlived our usefulness. My elder brother went to New York. He's in publishing, doing well. The rest of us are scattered up and down the earth. I'll say it's hard to get a job nowadays when you've nothing to say for yourself, except that you've had a public school education. Sometimes, if you're lucky, you get taken on as a reception clerk in a hotel. The tie and the manor are an asset there. The only job I could get was showman in a plumbing establishment, selling superb peach and lemon-coloured porcelain baths. Enormous showrooms, but as I never knew the price of the damn things or how soon we could deliver them, I got fired. The only things I could do were dance and play tennis. I got taken on at a hotel on the Riviera. Good pickings there. I suppose I was doing well. Then I overheard an old colonel, a really old colonel, incredibly ancient, British to the backbone and always talking about Pune. He went up to the manager and said at the top of his voice, 'Where's the gigolo? I want to get hold of the gigolo. My wife and daughter want to dance, you know. Where is the fella? What does he sting you for? It's the gigolo I want.'
Raymond went on, 'Silly to mind, but I did. I chucked it. Came here. Less pay, but pleasanter work. Mostly teaching tennis to rotund women who will never, never, never be able to play. That and dancing with the neglected wallflower daughters of rich clients. Oh, well, it's life, I suppose. Excuse today's hard luck story.' He laughed. His teeth flashed out white. His eyes crinkled up at the corners. He looked suddenly healthy and happy and very much alive. Sir Henry said, 'I'm glad to have a chat with you. I've been wanting to talk with you. About Ruby Keene? I can't help you, you know. I don't know who killed her. I knew very little about her. She didn't confide in me.' Miss Marple said, 'Did you like her?'
'Not particularly. I didn't dislike her.'
His voice was careless, uninterested. Sir Henry said, 'So you've no suggestions to offer?'
'I'm afraid not. I'd have told Harper if I had. It just seems to me one of those things. Petty, sordid little crime. No clues, no motive.'
'Two people had a motive,' said Miss Marple. Sir Henry looked at her sharply.
'Really?'
Raymond looked surprised. Miss Marple looked insistently at Sir Henry, and he said rather unwillingly,
'Her death probably benefits Mrs. Jefferson and Mr. Gaskell to the amount of £50,000.
What? Raymond looked really startled, more than startled, upset.
Oh, but that's absurd. Absolutely absurd. I mean, Mrs. Jefferson, and neither of them, could have had anything to do with it. It would be incredible to think of such a thing.'
Miss Marple coughed. She said gently, 'I'm afraid, you know, you're rather an idealist.'
I? He laughed. Not me. I'm a hard-boiled cynic.
Money, said Miss Marple, is a very powerful motive.
Perhaps, Raymond said hotly, but that either of those two would strangle a girl in cold blood.
He shook his head. Then he got up.
Here's Mrs. Jefferson now, come for her lesson. She's late.
His voice sounded amused.
10 minutes late.
Adelaide Jefferson and Hugo MacLean were walking rapidly down the path towards them. With a smiling apology for her lateness, Addie Jefferson went on to the court. MacLean sat down on the bench. After a polite inquiry whether Miss Marple minded a pipe, he lit it and puffed for some minutes in silence, watching critically the two white figures about the tennis court. He said at last,
"Can't see what Addie wants to have lessons for. Have a game, yes, no one enjoys it better than I do, but why lessons?" "Wants to improve her game," said Sir Henry. "She's not a bad player," said Hugo. "Good enough, at all events. Dash it all, she isn't aiming to play at Wimbledon."
He was silent for a minute or two. Then he said,
"Who is this Raymond fella? Where do they come from, these pros? Fella looks like a Dago to me." "He is one of the Devonshire stars," said Sir Henry.
"What? Not really?" Sir Henry nodded. It was clear that this news was unpleasing to Hugo MacLean. He scowled more than ever. He said,
"Don't know why Addie's sent for me. She seems not to have turned a hair over this business. Never looked better. Why send for me?"
Sir Henry asked with some curiosity,
"When did she send for you?"
"Oh, when all this happened."
"How did you hear? Telephone or telegram?"
"Telegram."
"As a matter of curiosity, when was it sent off?"
"Well, I don't know exactly."
"What time did you receive it?"
"I didn't exactly receive it. It was telephoned on to me, as a matter of fact."
"Why? Where were you?"
"Fact is, I'd left London the afternoon before. I was staying at Danebury Head."
"What? Quite near here."
"Yes. Rather funny, wasn't it? Got the message when I got in from a round of golf and came over here at once."
Miss Marple gazed at him thoughtfully. He looked hot and uncomfortable. She said, "I've heard it's very pleasant at Danebury Head, and not very expensive."
"No, it's not expensive. I couldn't afford it if it was. It's a nice little place."
"We must drive over there one day," said Miss Marple.
"Eh? What? Oh, yes, I should."
He got up.
"Better take some exercise, get an appetite."
He walked away stiffly.
"Women," said Sir Henry, "treat their devoted admirers very badly."
Miss Marple smiled, but made no answer.
"Does he strike you as rather a dull dog?" asked Sir Henry. "I'd be interested to know."
"A little limited in his ideas, perhaps," said Miss Marple, "but with possibilities, I think. Oh, definitely possibilities."
Sir Henry, in his turn, got up. "It's time for me to go and do my stuff. I see Mrs. Bantry is on her way to keep you company."
Mrs. Bantry arrived breathless and sat down with a gasp. She said,
"I've been talking to the chambermaids, but it isn't any good. I haven't found out a thing more. Do you think that girl can really have been carrying on with someone without everybody in the hotel knowing all about it?"
"That's a very interesting point, dear. I should say definitely not. Somebody knows, depend upon it, if it's true. But she must have been very clever about it."
Mrs. Bantry's attention had strayed to the tennis court. She said approvingly,
"Addie's tennis is coming along a lot. Attractive young man, that tennis pro. Addie is looking quite nice looking. She's still an attractive woman. I shouldn't be at all surprised if she married again."
"She'll be a rich woman, too, when Mr. Jefferson dies," said Miss Marple.
"Oh, don't always have such a nasty mind, Jane. Why haven't you solved this mystery yet? We don't seem to be getting on at all. I thought you'd know at once."
Mrs. Bantry's tone held reproach. "No, no, dear, I didn't know at once. Not for some time." Mrs. Bantry turned startled and incredulous eyes on her.
"You mean you know now who killed Ruby Keene?"
"Oh, yes," said Miss Marple. "I know that."
"But, Jane, who is it? Tell me at once."
Miss Marple shook her head very firmly and pursed up her lips. "I'm sorry, Dolly, but that wouldn't do at all."
"Why wouldn't it do?"
"Because you're so indiscreet. You would go round telling everyone,
or if you didn't tell, you'd hint. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't tell a soul. People who use that phrase are always the last to live up to it. It's no good, dear. There's a long way to go yet. A great many things that are quite obscure. You remember when I was so against letting Mrs. Partridge collect for the Red Cross, and I couldn't say why? The reason was that her nose had twitched in just the same way that that maid of mine, Alice, twitched her nose when I sent her out to pay the books. Always paid them a shilling or so short, and said it could go on to the next week's account, which, of course, was exactly what Mrs. Partridge did, only on a much larger scale. £75 it was she embezzled.
"Never mind, Mrs. Partridge," said Mrs. Bantry.
"But I had to explain to you, and if you care, I'll give you a hint. The trouble in this case is that everybody has been much too credulous and believing. You simply cannot afford to believe everything that people tell you. When there's anything fishy about, I never believe anyone at all. You see, I know human nature so well."
Mrs. Bantry was silent for a minute or two. Then she said, in a different tone of voice,
"I told you, didn't I, that I didn't see why I shouldn't enjoy myself over this case. A real murder in my own house. The sort of thing that will never happen again."
"I hope not," said Miss Marple.
"Well, so do I, really. Once is enough. But it's my murder, Jane, and I want to enjoy myself over it."
Miss Marple shot a glance at her.
Mrs. Bantry said belligerently, "Don't you believe that?"
Miss Marple said sweetly, "Of course, Dolly, if you tell me so."
"Yes, but you never believe what people tell you, do you? You've just said so. Well, you're quite right."
Mrs. Bantry's voice took on a sudden bitter note. She said,
"I'm not altogether a fool. You may think, Jane, that I don't know what they're saying all over St. Mary Mead, all over the county. They're saying, one and all, that there's no smoke without fire, that if the girl was found in Arthur's library, then Arthur must know something about it. They're saying that the girl was Arthur's mistress, that she was his illegitimate daughter, that she was blackmailing him. They're saying anything that comes into their damned heads, and it will go on like that. Arthur won't realize it at first. He won't know what's wrong. He's such a dear old stupid that he'd never believe people would think things like that about him. He'll be cold-shouldered and looked at askance, whatever that means, and it will dawn on him little by little, and suddenly he'll be horrified and cut to the soul, and he'll fasten up like a clam and just endure day after day in misery. It's because of all that's going to happen to him that I've come here to ferret out every single thing about it that I can. This murder's got to be solved. If it isn't, then Arthur's whole life will be wrecked, and I won't have that happen. I won't, I won't, I won't."
She paused for a minute and said,
"I won't have the dear old boy go through hell for something he didn't do. That's the only reason I came to Danemouth and left him alone at home, to find out the truth."
"I know, dear," said Miss Marple. "That's why I'm here, too."
End of Disc 4. Please continue with the next disc.